Think about your use of energy and how it might have changed over your lifetime. Do you drive a hybrid or all-electric car? Those are generally not around when you started driving, probably. Do you have solar panels on your house or otherwise have moved your energy consumption away from directly burning anything in your house? That's also the story of human history, figuring out better ways to stay warm, stay up late, and move ourselves over the earth at greater and greater speeds. Better didn't always mean better for either us or the Earth, usually not in the case of the Earth. Our guest this hour takes us on a journey through time. Richard Rhodes is the author of Energy, A Human History. Richard is a prolific historian and journalist with 24 books to his credit as either author or editor. The Making of the Atomic Bomb won him the Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction and several other prizes. Richard also contributes to PBS documentaries on Frontline and American Experience. Richard Rhodes, pleasure to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning. Well, talk of global warming, your three-digit temperatures up there.
It's you know, we get used to seeing 110 in Reading, for example, but it just seems to go on and starts earlier, too. You know, usually we get the lightning fires around the end of July. Here we got them in the middle.
Yes, exactly. That's the kind of change that we're facing these days.
Which is something that really does, it's a common theme from early on in this book, Energy, A Human History. And there's just so much perspective to gain here that there's always been a next thing in energy, hasn't there?
Fortunately for the species, yes, they've managed to find something. Not always to advantage. I mean, the Elizabethans burned wood, and when wood got too expensive, they had to switch to coal, which was a terrible material for them because their houses didn't have chimneys.
That was a thing. It was really amazing to me. How did people burn stuff in their houses when they were just burning wood?
Well, either there was just a straight hole up in the roof, in which case the smoke would eventually find it and drift out, or more typically, they let the wood smoke drift through the house and out the windows. They kind of liked it. They said it hardened the rafters, which is a funny comment, but who knows what they thought. They cooked with it, too, on a raised stone platform in kitchens. So they just seem to have breathed it as part of their normal days.
And anybody stop to think that if it was hardening the rafters, it might have been hardening their lungs, too?
Well, of course, lifespan in those days for males was about 40 years at best, and often younger for women because of childbirth. So they had, a rather shorter perspective on those things.
Probably. You know, it's clear right from the second page of the book that we always had trade-offs, and it was always power versus pollution, wasn't it?
It seems to have been, although I think now we're fortunately going in the other direction, so finally.
In the sense that we are gaining the upper hand over pollution, or trying to?
Well, both the global warming kind of pollution, but I'm thinking also of how, you know, picture of Beijing today, we all recoil in horror at the amount of pure smog and smoke in the air there, but it looks very much like the photographs I looked at of London in 1900 or Pittsburgh in 1930. It's only recently, really, that we began to be concerned about this larger world-scale problem of global warming, but we've been concerned. Well, the way I like to say it is the first thing people do is get their energy, and then they begin, as kind of a luxury good, to begin to try to clean up the air and the water and so forth so they can live better. And that seems to be the picture in all of these places.
There's a pointed reference in the book to that very thing where you say that people generally don't tend to think about the pollution things when they've discovered something new,
and
that certainly does seem to be the case.
And, you know, coal was promoted, coal smoke, I should say, in cities like Pittsburgh at the turn of the century was taken to be just kind of a benefit or an unnecessary annoyance that comes with the access to energy. People were so glad to have plenty of particularly electricity, that they accepted the coal smoke as just, well, that's the way the world is.
But the book is illustrated, and there are times when it got just plain horrible. You talked about Beijing now, but, I mean, there's an illustration, it's obviously a drawing, a pre-photograph, of torch boys, what are they, leading people through London on foggy days?
On smoggy smoke days, at high noon. And that comes from around, the drawing comes from around 1875. It was so thick then that you couldn't find your way through the streets. So there were street boys who had torches who would guide you. And I suppose pick your pocket while they were doing that.
I want to know a little side business here. So the book is divided in three major sections: power, light, and new fires. And you begin in 1598 in the London of Elizabeth and Shakespeare and the Globe Theater. Where did the wood for the Globe Theater come from?
Well, the wood originally, of course, had been cut for another theater, the first theater in London, which, with great inspiration, was called The Theater. Shakespeare and his pals, the Burbage brothers, owned the theater, and when the landlord who owned the land under the theater decided to foreclose the lease rather than let him have the building, which is what he really was after, he wanted to turn it into apartments, they simply set some guys up with swords and pikes to ward off his guys with swords and pikes, and in a couple of days tore down the old theater and moved the wood across the Thames to Southwark and built it in a larger form as the Globe. And that was, I think, one manifestation of just how expensive wood had become. One of the things that happens with distributed sources of energy is the farther away from the point of use you get, the more expensive it is to transport the material. So as the English cut down their trees farther and farther away from London, the wood got more and more expensive until people couldn't afford it anymore. That was just one early manifestation. The bigger one, of course, being they had to switch to coal.
All right. We'll talk about the switch to coal in just a moment and all the costs that came with that. Aside from the smoke, Richard Rhodes is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the author of Energy, A Human History. You can join us by phone and email. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is prolific and Pulitzer-winning author Richard Rhodes, who has written a book about our journey through history, looking for ways to keep ourselves warm, to keep ourselves in the light, and to move ourselves across the landscape. His book is called Energy, A Human History. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we move from burning wood in Shakespeare's time up to the power sources of today and tomorrow. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone, or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just getting into the switch in Elizabethan England from wood to coal. Wood was getting very dear because most of the trees had been cut down within a reasonable distance of London, but not for pollution reasons necessarily, or at least in the way we think of pollution scientifically now, but coal had a very bad rap, it appears, in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Yes. It's one of the funnier things I turned up in this rather bizarre history of the transition. Elizabethan preachers concluded very logically, they felt that if you found coal in layers underground, and if it was black and dirty as it was, and smelled of sulfur when you burned it, that it must be literally the devil's excrement, the devil living in hell down below somewhere in the center of the world. So they preached that from the pulpit, and it just added to the complexities of making a transition, and I think points out something that's consistent, which is new energy sources very often are not welcomed, even by people who would benefit from them because they're unfamiliar, and they don't necessarily fit into the existing situation. Most Elizabethan homes did not have chimneys. Burning coal was a totally different problem from burning wood, and eventually they had to backfit all their houses with chimneys in order to adapt.
Yikes. And so I just said, did people actually suffer for several years with old houses that didn't have chimneys burning coal in their wood?
Well, they
places?
Did, and they didn't know what to do, but wood was simply priced out. What happened, of course, is the aristocracy and the wealthy merchants continued to burn wood. And, I mean, there were homes where the living room, the home where the family lived was heated with wood, and the servants' quarters, they got the coal. So that's pretty typical of it. The transition happened primarily because of a social change. And this, again, is one of the underlying themes of the whole book. you know, we tend to think that with energy, when a new energy source is invented that might have superior qualities to the one we're using, that we'll just almost instantly overnight jump to it and start using it. But it turns out that there's an immense amount of social learning involved. And in this case, the really significant change came when Elizabeth died and James VI of Scotland came down to London to become James I. He, as a Scotsman, the Scots never had as much of a forest as the English anyway, and they had pretty much used up their wood in reasonable distances 100 years earlier. They also had a somewhat better quality coal that wasn't quite so sulfurous. Between those two things, they'd been burning coal for a long time, and when James came to London, he started burning coal. And then it was possible for people to say, oh, well, the king burns coal, so coal must be okay. And facilitate the transfer by changing their feelings about the material, which I think is one of the enduring themes of the whole book in a way.
Somebody has to lead the way, and another people have to pick up the cause.
Yes, exactly.
So we talked about the problems, obviously, at the burning end of using coal, but let's talk about at the other end of the process, getting out of the ground. Once the open pits in England were exhausted, what was needed to get coal from the ground?
Well, they began, of course, digging shafts and opening up tunnels underground, and that worked just fine. There was always some amount of water drainage into mines. There always is. But usually those mines outcropped on a hillside or on a seashore, and they were able to dig what they called adits, which were basically tunnels or channels for the water to drain out. But as they dug deeper, as they used the superficial coal and began to dig into deeper layers, you know, down as far down as 800 feet, the water accumulated in the mine and there was no way to drain it. And so the mines began to be drowned out, which means an enormous investment on the part of the people who owned the mine was going to be lost. And they just lived with that for a while. They tried pumping with horses, which helped to a degree, but you really can't get horses to pump much water 800 feet down. But then came the invention of an early form of the steam engine, which was almost completely driven by the problem of drowned mines and the enormous loss of investment that was involved. These early steam engines, and this is another theme about energy development, new machines typically are extremely inefficient. The first atmospheric steam engines, as they were called, were only about less than 1% efficient. So they were as large as houses. They'd sit on top of a shaft of a coal mine and pump the water out. But at least they solved that problem. Then they had the problem of moving the coal, which traditionally coal mines had been right at the edge of sloping hillsides or coastsides where they could basically take the coal downhill to barges that would then barge it on to London. But as they dug farther for more coal, as the demand increased, they moved back from the hillsides and the coastlines, and they had to carry the coal uphill as well as down. So then they needed some, and by then the steam engine had developed to the point where it was a much more efficient machine, therefore smaller, and could be put on wheels and used to haul wagons of coal. Well, it wasn't very long before someone realized that if you could haul wagons of coal, you could also haul people. And so the railroad was invented. So one could say that the railroad was the ultimate end product of digging coal.
So it's interesting that each necessity for a new invention eventually produced one and a refinement that led to all these great contraptions, which, of course, also happened to burn coal.
Right. And burning coal then became the whole reason, the whole structure behind the Industrial Revolution. In a way, the Industrial Revolution was entirely powered by coal and could not have happened without coal and the engines that followed from coal, so-called prime movers, things that turn energy into motion.
Richard Rhodes is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Energy, A Human History. You tease us at the start of the book with a still working version of a Thomas Newcomen steam engine.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
My wife and I went to England to research this book, and timed our visit to the 1 or 2 days a year when an old new common engine, which is one of these early atmospheric steam engines, literally inside of a big brick house, was going to be fired up and actually run. It's a reproduction of one of the originals. So we were there in the Midlands in England the day that machine was running. And the retired engineer who was operating it let us shovel some coal into the furnace. And I asked him about how he kept the machine going, because it was obviously an amazing collection of cranks and rods that would easily get out of line. And he held up a big old hammer and said, "This is my instrument for running this thing." But there it was, and the irony is coal is now so expensive in England that they can't run this thing every day anymore as they used to do. They have to run it just a couple of days a year. They can't afford it.
I'm struck with all the names of people who put refinements in. Denis Papin, the Frenchman, Thomas Newcomen, James Watt, Richard Trevithick, and the fact that in certainly some of the earlier cases, they really had to wait for technology to catch up to what they were thinking about, because you can't build a high-pressure steam apparatus unless you've got pipes that can handle high-pressure steam, for example.
Right, and I always like the story of the cylinders in the early steam engines were made round by hand using hammers and files. And their tolerance wasn't, you know, a tenth of a millimeter. Their tolerance was half an inch. So one of the things that James Watt spent a lot of time doing was trying to find some kind of material for gaskets to put around that hot cylinder as it went up and down. There was no rubber yet. There was no plastic yet. He tried leather. He tried straw. He tried wood. All of them damaged, of course, by the hot steam. He even tried horse manure, which I don't understand, but he was experimenting clearly. But eventually someone came along who figured out how to make a round cylinder and how to drill a round hole in the engine block, and was able then finally to get some kind of increased pressure, because the whole problem really was that the early engines were extremely low pressure and therefore had very large cylinders and didn't have much energy working.
Right, but then we ended up with steam locomotives that could haul trains at 100 miles an hour plus.
Right, yeah. Or even those early steam road carriages, which were chugging around London in the early days, scaring the horses.
Richard Rhodes, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is about our journey in search of the means to make ourselves warm and to let ourselves enjoy the night with some light and to move across the landscape. It is called Energy, A Human History. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Our phone lines are working today, 800-838-3760, working today and from this day forward, I should point out, 800-838-3760. If you'd like to join the conversation and share your thoughts on our use of energy and our quest for bigger, better things over time, you can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to move into part two of the book about light. And I had you know, some ideas about the things we used for light, but rushes, like bulrushes, is this what we're talking about?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, they have a central core, a pit, that is kind of like celery. It's full of little channels. And so people, and of course they grow alongside rivers and streams, so they're basically free. People would cut them and dry them and then strip off all but one little supportive strip of the outer hard casing, and then soak them in any kind of available grease or fat, like bacon fat, and let them cool. And they would burn like a candle, not quite as bright a light, but a free light, and that was typically the way people lived for hundreds and hundreds of years, with no more light at night than a few rushes burning in a little kind of a roach clip device that held the rush while it burned. I was surprised at how late it was toward our time before people began to get better quality lighting. I mean, the only way you could get more light in a room was basically to use more candles or more rushes, and the wealthy had actually mirrors that were set up behind a multi-branched candelabra that would hold candles to get more light. But it was a pretty inefficient way to light the world, and whaling came along, and of course whale oil was a wonderful oil for lighting. It burned very bright, and it didn't smell the way sheep wax does or beef tallow does. or even another common source of lighting was all the various kinds of vegetable oils. The English had hazelnut oil, and which must have smelled pretty good. Most of Europe had olive oil. But whale oil, and particularly spermaceti, which is actually a wax, made beautiful candles and oil. But it was expensive. Someone had to go out and catch a whale. At the height of the whaling industry around the 1840s, Nantucket in particular, which in a way was kind of the world center of whaling, was knocking off a total of 10,000 whales a year.
Wow.
So the whales retreated down, once the North Atlantic was fished out, down the east coast of South America and around the Horn and up the west coast of South America with the whalers chasing after them, and then across the equator, across the Pacific. Finally, they retreated into the Sea of Japan and then up into the Arctic. And as the distance increased, here we go again, it got more and more expensive to catch a whale. Whaling trips that in Melville's time might take 2 years ended up taking 6 with all the added expense that you can imagine. So whale oil and whale wax kind of got priced out. But most people didn't realize, I certainly didn't realize, that the really common material for lamp lighting until the discovery of petroleum was in fact turpentine from southeastern United States pine forest, mm-hmm. vast pine forest that would be tapped rather like a maple tree is tapped for their it wasn't a sap, it was actually a kind of a band-aid material that the trees exuded, which was turpentine. That was then mixed with grain alcohol and a little bit of menthol to cut the smell, you know what turpentine smells like.
Yeah.
And that was made into something called camphene, which was the standard liquid material for lamplight. Until, unfortunately, the Civil War, when the North blockaded all the ports of the South, and the turpentine couldn't be shipped up North. So there was a reversion to vegetable oils for a while, but then petroleum had been discovered in 1859 in Pennsylvania, of course, and its main product was kerosene. And kerosene became the standard lamplight material for the rest of the 19th century and in rural America well into the 20th century. However, there was an interesting problem with refining petroleum in that you had byproducts that were basically waste, such as, of all things, gasoline. Gasoline could not be used in lamps. It was much too volatile. It would blow up. So it had no commercial value and was typically dumped into rivers at night, standard sort of tricks of people who don't want to pay for the disposal of their waste products, or just simply dumped on the ground and allowed to evaporate.
Wow. So this is one of actually two common themes here. Number one is that when the stuff that you have to travel farther for just gets too expensive to get, you look for things to burn closer by, which is where we get the petroleum thing in the first place. But the other one, of course, is the idea that, we don't know what this stuff is. Let's just throw it in the river and that'll carry it away.
Exactly. I mean, American rivers were just totally polluted in the 19th century. Slaughterhouse waste was routinely dumped into rivers, too. So you can imagine what a mess they were.
I wanted to ask about Edwin Drake and the early oil exploration in Pennsylvania, which is where we first had oil in the United States. I mean, it sounds like he came very close to being cut off by his investors.
He was, because no one had ever drilled for oil. The only use of petroleum before Drake's discovery was as, this is hard to believe, but it was drunk as a tonic. It was rubbed on the body as a liniment. Something that I guess whites in America had learned from the Indians, who used, but it oozed out at some places where the deposits were close to the surface. It oozed out in stream beds and along the ground, and would be collected by people bottling it for medicine by putting a wool blanket or a coat onto the surface of the water, which would then, of course, soak up the lighter oil that floated on top. And then they'd wring out these saturated materials into bottles and sell it for for its health benefits, if one can imagine. So that was as far as anyone had gotten. However, for many, many years, people had been drilling for salt water. And I never understood why people needed so much salt until it dawned on me one day as I was reading that there was no refrigeration. The only way you could preserve foods was to turn cucumbers into pickles and meat into salted and smoked meat. So people needed a lot of salt, which is why salt had been a standard tax for thousands of years. But they had perfected drilling for salt water down as far as hundreds of feet underground. And it was this technology that Colonel Drake, who was actually a railroad conductor who was hired by some investors in New Haven, Connecticut, who owned the land in Pennsylvania where the oil was seeping out of the ground. He had been hired largely because he had a lifetime railroad pass, and they wouldn't have to pay for his transportation back and forth.
All right, let's pick it up there on the other side of a break. Our guest is Richard Rhodes. His book is Energy, A Human History. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Richard Rhodes and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our efforts through human history to turn on the lights and keep our houses warm and move ourselves across the landscape have led us to burn some pretty amazing things. And now, maybe just now, we're getting to where we're not burning as much, or at least we're thinking about a period when we won't burn as much. Richard Rhodes tracks all this in his book, Energy, A Human History. This is the same Richard Rhodes who won the Pulitzer Prize for The Making of the Atomic Bomb and also appears on PBS documentaries on Frontline and American Experience. You can join the conversation about energy through history, how we use it, how we abuse it, how we abuse the earth in the process of using energy. All topics for discussion on the exchange. The phone lines are open at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking still about fossil fuels and petroleum out of the ground. And let's stay in the fossil fuel vein and take a call from Ben in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, I saw a movie recently where it was portrayed that there's a giant seam of coal that starts in Spain and goes under the Sea of Biscayne into England and Wales, and that's how England and Wales became so popular for coal and the start of the Industrial Revolution. And then it goes under the Atlantic Ocean and comes out in Pennsylvania, and that's what brought the coal industry and the Industrial Revolution to America. And I wonder, is that true? Does coal go that deep under oceans and come out on the other side of the planet?
You know, I'm not sure that it actually goes under the Atlantic, but remember that North America and Africa's are really Central and South America and Africa split off from each other millions and millions of years ago, so that you can match up the east coast of South America with the west coast of Africa, and allowing for the continental shelf, they fit together beautifully. And it's one of the ways that connection was discovered was because there were mineral veins that started in South America and continued in Africa. So I think that may be the basis for what the message was. So there is a connection, but I don't know that it goes underneath the ocean. I doubt it, because, of course, coal is the remains of old plants and continental shelf materials. So,
all right. Yeah, stuff that got crushed far deep underground. Vince, thanks for the question from Eugene. I want to talk about the fact that at the time that we were just getting into oil in the United States, that there were developments in electricity going on around the same time. And was the key, Richard, to being able to generate it?
With electricity, well, the first problem really was to make a light bulb that was sufficient. I mean, Edison went through several thousand iterations using different filament materials before he finally found one that wouldn't burn up when you're running a current of electricity through it. It was actually a kind of Japanese bamboo, carbonized. Later on, of course, they went to tungsten and materials that really did work, But at the same time, generating electricity really got into a big debate about what kind of electricity you're going to generate. Edison, because all of his early inventions had worked with batteries, the battery, of course, preceding generated electricity by several hundred years, all the way back to Volta in 1700, and Ben Franklin and others working on these things. So Edison was familiar with low voltage direct current, which is the kind that comes out of batteries. And when he developed a generating system using steam engines to turn over generators to generate electricity, he stayed with that kind of current. Interesting continuity there. And that's pretty much a common theme across the ages as well, that you often stay with some aspects of an earlier technology because you're familiar with it, even though it may not work as well as some other kind. The alternative was alternating current, which was generated in the same way, but by a different kind of generator, and had the great advantage that it could be stepped up and stepped down using transformers. Direct current was so resistant to moving through a wire that someone, I quote, said that if you tried to run direct current from Wall Street up to 59th Street in New York City, you'd need a wire as big around as a man's leg. And that was about right. Well, the big debate, the big struggle really came, the big competition between the two kinds of current came with the decision about what kind of current to generate at Niagara Falls, which was finally built as a hydropower system in the 1890s. And there was a great contest between Westinghouse, which was pushing alternating current, and the Edison people. And since you couldn't transport the electricity very efficiently to a great distance, and since Niagara Falls was then, as it pretty much is now, isolated off by itself, alternating current won out, and therefore, in a way, swept the country after that. It just was better for moving it around than direct current was.
I knew that DC kind of dyed the wires pretty easily, but I didn't realize that's how big the wire would have to be. That's amazing.
Well, so Edison's system was always just local. You'd have a generating plant in the middle of town, and you'd generate for about a half mile around the plant. Then you'd have to have another plant. Whereas with alternating, you could run it for thousands of miles, and they very quickly did.
And electricity, as you point out, led by the 1880s to trolley and trolley cars, and cities installed them by the armload. And that really changed urban organization, though, as you point out.
The people who were promoting the use of electric trolleys were buying up the suburban land around cities and selling the land to the whole new world in America of suburbanites who could live far away, relatively far away. You know, the first towns had been basically no more than about 2 miles in diameter because that was as far as a person could walk to work on a regular basis. Now it was possible to surround cities with suburbs and ride efficient electric trains in and out of town. It could be as far as an hour away. People could read the newspaper and generally spend their mornings getting ready for work. So it transformed the whole urban landscape of America. Another thing that happens when new kinds of energy come along.
Well, and then that raises a question about other forms of transportation, which brings us to the internal combustion engine. We've talked about steam, the external combustion engine, and I wonder if the engine itself was developed because, as you pointed out, there were byproducts of making kerosene that nobody could find a use for, gasoline being one of them.
Yeah, I think the internal combustion engine really was an outgrowth, in a way, of the steam engine. The engine itself, the cylinder and the piston and so forth, are comparable in both machines. The difference is that one has steam expanding inside the cylinder and the other has some kind of fuel. It was a pursuit on the part, particularly of some German inventors and scientists by now, to make an engine that was more efficient, one that would, the fuel and everything would all be happening in the same place instead of having an external tank, a boiler, where you had to heat water to steam and so forth. And they wanted something that could be started up right away. And one of the problems of the first steam automobiles is that you'd have to wait 20 minutes to get up ahead of steam before you could drive out of your garage. So that was partly solved by the introduction of a pilot light that would keep the water in the steam boiler hot enough that it would very quickly, within, let's say, 5 minutes, get up enough steam to move around. steam engines, steam cars were really nice little machines, but the pursuit of a more efficient engine is what led to the internal combustion engine. And notice that it would burn any number of different kinds of fuel. So at the beginning of the 20th century, when there were only about 2,000 or 3,000 automobiles in the entire country, they came in different kinds. The first Model Ts, if anyone wants to see this, go to a museum where there's an old Model T. There was a flex fuel switch right next to the steering column on the car that would allow you to switch from the carburetor from processing gasoline to processing alcohol, because Henry Ford wanted to do something for farmers, and he thought that farmers could use their corn to make grain alcohol, which could then be used for his automobiles, and the farmers would prosper and so forth. As it happened, the years between about 1900 and 1920 were the most prosperous years in all of Americans' agricultural history, because so many people were moving from the farm to the city, and farmers could use their corn to feed cattle. The meat would then go into the city and be sold to the people in the cities. They didn't want to waste their corn on making grain alcohol. It just wasn't worth the money compared to the other possibility. So gasoline won the day, and it won the day over electrics, even though electrics were better than cranked automobiles with internal combustion engines. The crank was so hard to turn that many women couldn't do it. So the electric was a very popular car among women. I noticed, by the way, that the batteries in the electrics around 1900 would get your car about 30 miles, which is the same order of magnitude as batteries today for most of the electrics that have been around so far.
Oh, for traveling, sure.
We have not improved the battery very much.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, one of the things you point out, too, when you talk about Henry Ford and farmers, I wonder if he felt a debt to them because he was putting a lot of them out of business once people would buy cars and no longer need horses.
That's true. In fact, the whole horse story is another story that I tell at some length, and I won't try to draw it out here, but it's a pretty amazing story, too. I mean, there were 100,000 horses in Manhattan in 1900 being used for carting things around, not for personal transport. But with the coming of the automobile, and it was so much less expensive to keep a car because when you turned it off, you didn't have to so-called feed it. Horses had to be fed. They had to be maintained. They were much more difficult. They had vast amounts of manure in a city that had to be cleaned up and moved out of town, and urine. They became very much a notorious pollutant source once they were no longer useful, once the car and the truck replaced them. A sad story. They were, by 1930, all those millions of American horses were all rapidly being converted into pet food. I mean...
Yeah, so I want to move into a different realm here, partly based on a question from Sandy, no town given, who wants to ask for your comments on nuclear power. I do notice you talk about having the nuclear age start with the bombings of Japan left an almost indelible taint. But Sandy recalls you wrote a book defending it, from what she remembers?
Yeah, it was called Nuclear Renewal. It was published in the mid-90s. Well, look, I looked at all the main energy sources that we're looking at today, primarily to deal with global warming, secondarily to deal with air pollution, although not so secondarily in China and India, where they still have 19th century levels of air pollution that are really pretty deadly and would like to. China and India are going nuclear in a major way these days, partly because they need the energy, partly because they want to clean up their air. I think nuclear power, and I say this after advisedly, I really did look very carefully, and I've spent years speaking with the inventors of all these technologies in the course of writing about nuclear weapons. I think nuclear is a very important baseload source of energy that we're going to have to rethink for those who feel that it's somehow uniquely dangerous. It's not. Even with the accidents that have occurred at Chernobyl and Fukushima, the death rate per, let's say, kilowatt hour of nuclear is far, far, far lower than the death rate from any other source of energy, including solar. Accidents occur when you're manufacturing, when you're putting up and taking down the solar systems. The same is true with wind turbines. And the fact is, nuclear has a very clean record in that regard. The radiation that people fear so much turns out not to have been as high as they might think based on the kind of news coverage that we've had. Some of the level of radiation directly outside the Fukushima wire, as it were, was lower than the level that's common on the beaches of Brazil, where there's a lot of low radioactive sand that people lie on when they're getting suntanned. So it's really something that needs another look. I say that it's the devil's excrement of the 20th century, because people have the same kind of exaggerated sense that it has some unique problem that can't be solved. There are two nuclear waste sites presently in the process of being opened, one in southern New Mexico and one in an island off the coast of Finland, that can reliably and permanently store any nuclear waste that we decide we need to bury forever.
All right.
So I see it as one part, and I don't mean to suggest it's some magic solution. I think given the rapidity of the approach of serious global warming, we're going to need everything we've got that is low carbon or non-carbon. And I mean the renewables where they fit the situation. I mean natural gas as a load following thing for the fact that renewables constantly go up and down with the changes in sunlight and changes in wind velocity. You need something that's right there to fill in the gap when that happens. Mm-hmm. And natural gas is probably the best solution to that. Right. You can't really easily do that with nuclear, because nuclear plant takes a couple of days to get up and fully running.
So a whole portfolio, to be sure, and a lot covered in the book. It's called Energy, A Human History. Richard Rhodes, its author, our guest. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.